How's it going, everybody? This is the Solid Monster here, and it is Sound Off 107. Indeed, we are back here on SCScoops.com. It is Saturday, April 24th, 2010. So happy to be back with you. Back from my vacation, among other things, and a shitload of work when I got back. But we've got a lot to get to. Obviously, a lot of things have happened the last 2 weeks. A bunch of WWE superstars cut from their contracts, wrestlers stranded overseas, a new TNA champion, SmackDown moving to a different network, and whole bunch of different things here. I'll talk a little bit about my trip to Costa Rica later in the show, time permitting. Give you some thoughts on how things went and you know, the kind of place that it is. It really is a beautiful place. We'll get to all that. But I want to start things off with the most recent news, and that, of course, would be seven WWE superstars have been given their notice. They are gone from World Wrestling Entertainment. Roll call here. Mickie James being one of them, former women's champion. Shelton Benjamin. Katie Lee Burchill, Sho Funaki, or Kung Funaki, as it were, Jimmy Wang Yang, Ray Gordy, who, of course, was both Jesse from the Jesse and Festus tag team, as well as Slam Master Jay, and Mike Knox. Now, a couple of these names jump out at me as surprising, and I probably would have to put Mike Knox at the top of that list, in all honesty. Now, I don't watch as much of SmackDown as I'd like to. I certainly watch more Raw than I do SmackDown, and so I don't get to see Mike Knox on my TV very much. But I know Mike Knox has been around for a while, going back to really 2006 when they relaunched the ECW brand on Sci-Fi. Mike Knox originally came in. He was paired off with Kelly Kelly. Paul Heyman, actually, was a big proponent of his, thought the world of him. He's a big guy. Was a little green at first, but he's really come into his own in recent years. And obviously he's gotten bigger physically, wider, and he's grown out a phenomenal beard. And I saw Mike Knox on TV last night when he essentially jobbed to JTG, and he is a scary-looking dude. And it made me think to myself, why would they cut somebody like this? I mean, he fits the mold of somebody that WWE likes. He's got the size. He's somebody who I think, with the right push, can easily be pushed as a monster. He certainly looks scary enough. You never really heard stories about him catching heat with anybody or causing trouble. And for that reason alone, I think Mike Knox may be the most surprising cut of them all. Now, Funaki's pretty surprising as well. He's been around in the company since 1998. So he was the longest tenured wrestler to be cut this past week. And from what I understand, WWE used him in other capacities other than in the ring. Obviously, he used to do announcing on TV, you know, SmackDown number one announcer, and that was all funny and stuff. But they've used him and his ability to speak Japanese overseas. He's come in handy, I guess you might say, for the company. And again, very well liked. Actually, pretty good friends, from what I understand, with wrestlers like Steve Austin and Shawn Michaels. I know he and Shawn Michaels both reside in San Antonio, Texas. So that was a surprising cut as well. He's kind of a versatile guy. He was never going to be a world champion, but he's been around for a long time. He's a pretty good wrestler. He speaks multiple languages. Everybody likes him. He stays out of trouble. So for that reason alone, it was surprising to me. Now, Mickie James and Shelton Benjamin, obviously, I can't really say that Shelton was a surprise. I think it's the most, maybe right up there with Mike Knox, as being the most egregious cut of the bunch. The fact that they could not come up with something for Shelton to do to maximize his talents is ridiculous. And, you know, Shelton has to shoulder part of the blame. He's not the most charismatic guy in the world. He's been accused of, maybe not to the degree that Carlito has. And by the way, the fact that Shelton was cut and Carlito is still under contract is another thing that surprises me. But, you know, Shelton Benjamin is an immensely talented performer. Just unbelievably talented. And the fact that he was fired because they didn't have anything for him or they felt he went as far as he could, to me, is just a ridiculous notion. Charlie Haas, who was cut from the company a few months back, has done interviews recently saying that he's been urging Shelton to leave the company when his contract was up in a few months. And obviously Shelton won't have to worry about that now since the company made the decision for him. And by the way, I think them cutting Shelton Benjamin and a lot of these people, including Mickie James, speaks volumes to how much WWE is, in fact, not worried at all about TNA. I remember, I think it was last year, Charlie Haas, I believe, wanted a release from his contract. He was unhappy. And instead of cutting him loose, WWE actually gave him a pay raise. but he never appeared on TV. So essentially what they did was they gave Charlie Haas a pay raise, and the reason they did that was to keep him from signing with another organization like TNA. And I think WWE has seen TNA perform the way that they have on Spike recently, and they're not worried anymore about any of these people signing because they know it's really not going to make a difference. Now, for Shelton, it can make a big difference because if he can sign with TNA, let's say, maybe him and Haas can go in together. They can reform their world's greatest tag team gimmick, maybe even partner up again with Kurt Angle. It would be something big for Shelton's career, for Charlie's career. I hope they do that. I they don't have to be paired up with Kurt Angle. You know, we've seen that already. We don't have to go back to that. But I think him and Haas make a great tag team. And, you know, TNA's got a couple of great teams. They've got the Motor City Machine Guns. They've got Beer Money. Those are their two, in my opinion, their two primary tag teams. Haas and Benjamin, let's say, coming in together as a team, I think would only bolster that. I'm not saying it's a definite, but, you know, let's be honest here. Where else is there for Shelton to go? Unless he goes to Ring of Honor, and I just don't see that happening. Mickie James, former women's champion, very popular diva. There's been talk of fans who are going to riot this weekend at the Extreme Rules pay-per-view, you know, in protest of them cutting Mickie. You know, I don't know if they're going to actually do that or not, but, you know, Mickie had a bit of heat on her. In particular, this past week, from what I understand, she was not a favorite figure coming out of that European tour. There were many times when she was the one responsible for holding up the tour bus because she was late and people were knocking her for it. And of course, you know, WWE was for the longest time accusing her of even if not directly, certainly the way they positioned her on TV as being overweight and mocking the fact that, you know, she's Piggy James and all that. So she's had a bit of heat on her for a while. I think what really pushed them over the edge here was the fact that they saw Mickie was getting a little too big for her britches. You know, they cut Maria before Maria would really come out of the Celebrity Apprentice show that she's on right now as a big star. They've seen it before. Divas who have outside projects and they go on to do bigger things. They get a big head or whatever. And that was WWE's logic behind cutting Maria. And I think you might have seen a little bit of that here with Mickie James. She's been recording some music. She had her first country music single. She's doing outside projects, and I think WWE just saw that and what happened this past week on the European tour, and they said, you know what, fuck this, we don't need this, you're out of here. It's a shame because their women's division is in dire straits right now. I love Maryse to death, but she's a terrible wrestler. Beth Phoenix may be the only serviceable female wrestler they really have left on either roster. You know, Eve is coming along, Eve Torres, the women's champion on Raw, but she's not that good. And as far as the rest of the divas are concerned, I still maintain that one of these days, one of them is going to break their neck. You know, when Gail Kim, I don't know if it's because Gail Kim just hasn't been given the opportunity. She's been a disappointment since she came back to WWE. You know, when Trish Stratus left, really it was Mickie James and Beth Phoenix were the two women who were there who could actually wrestle, who picked up the slack and carried the division. And now that Mickie is gone, I think it's bad news for the WWE divas. Now, on that subject, I think it's worth noting that, you know, the Cauliflower Alley Club had their annual ceremony in Vegas this week. Jim Ross was there. He was honored with an award that was presented to him by Steve Austin, who came to town specifically to present JR with the award, which was kind of cool. Ted DiBiase was there. He received an award. Dan Severn. Awesome Kong was one of many wrestlers who showed up to be a part of the Cauliflower Alley Club ceremony. She met Steve Austin, and she was on her Twitter saying how it was such an honor to meet Stone Cold and all of this. And Jim Ross, I think, was the one who made a comment. Even Steve Austin, on his Twitter page, made a comment. You know, because Kong actually sent Austin a comment on Twitter. This is what the world has come to. Thanking him and talking about what a pleasure it was to meet him. And Austin responded back to Kong and said, look, you know, good luck. For WWE not to pick you up would be insane. And I agree. I think WWE should pick up Awesome Kong. Maybe that would light a fire under Gail Kim's ass. I mean, the two of them are really responsible for bringing the TNA Knockouts division to a level of respectability that, quite frankly, since both left the company, they have not been able to return to. And I think that they could do a lot with Kong and, you know, giving her a monster gimmick. Maybe she could be somebody's heavy in WWE, you know, Vicky Guerrero or somebody like that. I don't know. But, you know, Mickie James gone is not good news for the women's division. So they're going to have to address that. Now, I'm not a big fan of women's wrestling to begin with, and it's not the fault of the women necessarily. It's because they don't handle the divisions in the right way. And this certainly won't help. So, sucks to be any of those seven that were released. I'm sure they'll all land on their feet. I would imagine all of them have a 90-day non-compete, so I would not expect any one of those people to show up immediately, for example, on TNA television. We'll just have to wait and see where they end up. I think some of them certainly will end up on Spike. Maybe some of them will end up in Ring of Honor, but we shall see. Let's see. What do we want to talk about next? The Raw crew. We may as well talk about their unbelievable European tour that they came back from this past week. And I can tell you this. You know, I flew out on my trip week before last. You know, it's a five-hour flight. Pretty simple, pretty straightforward, no stops, nonstop. And on the way home, for whatever reason, the flight home, which actually was shorter because we left a little earlier, and the flight time returning home to New York was listed at, I think, 4 hours and 37 minutes. And that flight felt like triple that. It just was the longest flight ever. I couldn't wait to get home. And yet, I find myself complaining about that, and then I see what the Raw crew had to go through, and it makes me shake my head. You know, what am I bitching about? Here are these guys. They're taking tour buses for 7 hours at a time. They have to take ferries. They can't fly out of the country. They can't see their families. They can't go home. It's a shitty situation to be in. You know, the one saving grace, I suppose, you know, them having a couple of extra days in the country and no shows to work, maybe they had time to really explore Belfast or explore Europe. You know, normally they go in for these tours, bang, 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 and they leave. So they tour the world, but they really don't have a chance to stop and take a breath and really enjoy their different experiences in these countries. Maybe they were able to do that, maybe not. I don't know. It sucks. Thankfully, they came back. I believe it was on Wednesday. So basically, they did not make it for Raw Monday night. They weren't even able to make it back for the SmackDown tapings on Tuesday. The Raw crew is home. They are safe and sound. They will be at the pay-per-view this Sunday. So what we got on Monday night was Monday Night SmackDown, which, in my opinion, was not a very good show. And I can only criticize WWE Creative so much because I understand the situation they were in. They had to rewrite an entire show at the last minute, which isn't exactly true. I think by Saturday they kind of knew they might not get their wrestlers back, and by Saturday afternoon they were already starting to rewrite the show. So they had a little bit of time, but I'll cut them some slack. Maybe the show they had originally written was a blow-away home run show. I doubt that, but maybe. Although that doesn't excuse the MacGruber stuff. But we'll get to that in a second. So I'll give them a pass. I just didn't like this show. I thought Jack Swagger and The Undertaker had a pretty good match. Undertaker is just, it's hard to watch him wrestle because he just looks like he's in so much pain, and you know he actually is. You know, WrestleMania, I didn't really think about it too much, and I think for WrestleMania, you kind of suck it up and you go, but for whatever reason, in this match, he just looked like he was in so much pain. And again, he was called in last minute on emergency duty. He was taking time off. The company called him. They said, "We need you. Can you fly in?" He came in. He did what he had to do. I respect that. What I don't respect is the outcome of the match. Now, they seem to have a gimmick going where Jack Swagger is losing every week, so I guess it kind of fits the gimmick. I don't understand why you would want to position one of your world champions with a gimmick where he loses every single week. I don't get that. That was the wrong outcome to that match. Having Undertaker pin him clean on the go-home show to a pay-per-view where we're supposed to care about the fact that this man is defending his title against Randy Orton is not the way to go. Have a schmoz, have a DQ, have a no contest, have him walk out, which would have been just as shitty, but at least he would have been able to save face. Instead, he gets Tombstone, 1-2-3, and it just makes me think, why even put the belt on him in the first place? Now, just when I thought it couldn't get any worse, I watched SmackDown on Friday night. I saw, again, another really good match. Jack Swagger and John Morrison had a great match at the beginning of the show. And John Morrison cleanly pins Swagger with the Starship Pain. I was just amazed. When I read the spoiler, so I was expecting it, but even watching it, I was amazed. As good a match as they had, what is the purpose of having your world champion lose clean to a guy who, as talented as he may be, has been positioned as a mid-card guy on a secondary brand? Now, if Swagger loses to Orton this Sunday, he's dead in the water. He has to win. But even if he wins, I don't see what is gained from positioning him as a loser heading into the pay-per-view. I certainly am not provoked to spend my money on this pay-per-view this Sunday because Jack Swagger is losing every week. It is completely the opposite of what you are expected to do when you have a champion holding a title. This is the worst way you could possibly build a champion. In fact, it reminds me of when Rey Mysterio was champion in 2006, and I'm not even sure that Rey was booked worse than Jack Swagger has been booked. And Rey was booked as a pretty bad champion back then. At least when Great Khali beat him clean on TV, you could say, okay, is Rey Mysterio, who's, you know, 5'3", 150 pounds soaking wet, losing to a guy that was quite literally 15 times his size? But for Jack Swagger to lose clean to The Undertaker and then John Morrison, just doesn't make any sense. So anyway, Raw, Swagger and Undertaker had a good match with a shitty ending. Really not much else to talk about. I mean, I know a lot of people were upset. I know I certainly was at first seeing Triple H pin in that main event of all people. He patapinned CM Punk with a pedigree to get the win on Monday night. From what I understand, from what I read, from a reliable website, a reliable newsletter who I trust, that was actually CM Punk's call. You know, originally it was going to be Luke Gallows getting pedigreed and pinned by Triple H, and Punk went to bat and said, look, it should be me. Because he was afraid that, you know, Gallows has been losing lately, and he didn't want Gallows to look weak. I would imagine that perhaps they're setting up a breakup with maybe even a program between Punk and Gallows, and Punk wants to make sure that Luke is not, you know, looked at as a complete jobber. I'm sure there must have been some sort of agenda to it, but Punk basically sacrificed himself. He had the ending changed. He wanted to be pinned, and so he was. And Triple H stands tall at the end of the show with Edge and Rey Mysterio. Not a good show. The MacGruber stuff, I actually am a fan of MacGruber. I don't watch Saturday Night Live very often. It's just not funny. It hasn't been for, 10 years. But the MacGruber stuff I get a kick out of, and I think the reason why is because it's in such short doses. Basically, here's a skit. It's a spoof on an old TV show called MacGyver. I'm sure many of you know that, and some of you don't. There was a TV show in the late 80s into the early 90s with Richard Dean Anderson called MacGyver. This guy was incredible in that he could defuse a bomb if you gave him a rubber band, a paper clip, and some chewing gum. Okay? He was totally ridiculous, but I ate that shit up as a kid. So MacGruber, of course, is a spoof on that. They actually just made a full-length movie, which I'm anxious to see. There's a lot of WWE wrestlers in the movie. You saw the trailer on Monday night. Chris Jericho has a role in it. Mark Henry, Kane, Great Khali, MVP, I think maybe one other person. It should be funny. The thing is, when you take MacGruber out of those 2-minute skits, and you have to, and this maybe is why the movie will suck, I don't know, but having to watch MacGruber over and over and over, and again, we know they're actors, and they're in character, and it just makes a fake wrestling show look that much more fake. I've enjoyed some of these guest hosts. Bob Barker was great. Jesse Ventura was great. Shaq was good, of course. There's been a couple of other really good ones. MacGruber and his female companion there, I wouldn't put them on the best of the guest hosts. His selling, of course, in that quote-unquote match with Vladimir Kozlov was atrocious. I can't fault Will Forte for that because he's not a wrestler. I could fault the stupid writers who put him in the ring in a fake match that looked even more fake than it should have looked. So, Raw sucked, let's be honest. It was a shitty show overall, which is, amazingly, in direct contrast to Impact, which, by and large, based on all the feedback, people thought it was a phenomenal show on Monday night. I did not see the entire show, but I saw the parts that mattered. I saw the RVD-Jeff Hardy match, which I thought was actually better than the RVD-AJ Styles match, which was really good in and of itself. So I saw the title change. I saw the Samoa Joe comeback. You know, it was just one appearance, but it looked like they were going back to the formula of positioning Joe as this psycho killer heel, which, of course, is the way he should have been positioned all along. They took that shit off his face, the tattoo or whatever. He's not walking around with a machete threatening to chop off people's dicks. It's a good situation for Joe to be back on TV and to be positioned as somebody who should be feared, because he should. RVD winning the title, I liked it. I thought it would it's a nice change. It's good to change things up every now and then. And they made the title important. You know, the Hulk Hogan speech at the beginning of the show, everybody talking about how much the belt means, and then the big celebration at the end. I really, really, really enjoyed it. I think now they have to keep the belt on RVD for a little bit. If he loses it back right away to AJ Styles or somebody else, it just completely defeats the purpose. I think RVD could be a strong champion. I think he would have been in WWE, but of course he shot himself in the foot. They had to take the belt off him, so his reign a couple years back wasn't, also was probably about a month long, We'll see where they go with this. I read some of the spoilers for Impact this Monday night. The show on paper for this Monday does not read very well, so I'm a little concerned. But, you know, sometimes the shows when they air on TV turn out to be far better than they read on paper, so we'll see. Yeah, they're going to be demolished on Monday night up against the three-hour draft. They know that. But let's hope they can keep this up. You know, one good show is great, but you're going to have a good show consistently. Now, when I watched what I watched from Impact on Monday, I thought to myself, maybe Vince Russo took a sick day. But no, in fact, this was a Vince Russo-written show. So I will give the devil his due. Vince Russo booked a good wrestling show on Monday night. I still maintain that the man should be fired. He does not know how to book wrestling good consistently. One good show does not change a person's track record. I'm really happy that Impact had a good show. I hope they have a good show every single week and that people pick up on that, word of mouth spreads, and the Impact rating goes up. It was up to a 1.0, which is still down from what they were doing on Thursday nights, but it's up from the 0.6 they did a couple of weeks ago, which was almost emergency territory. Good for them. But let's see where they go from here. Now, as far as Vince Russo is concerned, the rumors going around are that Russo is about to step down as the head of creative. He is supposedly burnt out. I don't know if he's legitimately burnt out or if he just kind of knows that his days may be numbered and maybe he just wants to get out of there before he gets fired. He'll still be with TNA in some other capacity, but he may well be relieving himself of writing duties very, very soon. And you would think, this is great. We get what we want. Now they can bring in a person who actually knows what they're doing. And Paul Heyman's name is being bandied about a lot, especially in the company. A lot of wrestlers in the company, especially the old ECW guys that are there, are convinced. They are convinced that Heyman is on his way in. And then I read other people, again, very reliable wrestling websites and wrestling reporters, people who are connected to Heyman who say there's no way he's coming in. There's just no way. He's just not interested. He has outside projects. He's in the process of writing two different books. He has the Heyman Hustle on the Crave website. He is not interested in coming into TNA. It's just a matter of who you believe. Is it impossible to think that Paul Heyman could end up in there? Absolutely not. He could very well end up there. Do I think he will? I don't. I mean, I certainly think there's a better chance of Paul Heyman, for example, going to TNA than Jim Ross. There's been just as many rumors of Jim Ross going in. And Jim Ross had a meeting, supposedly, with Bob Carter and Dixie Carter sometime early last month. Now, Ross just put a Twitter up just before I went on to record this podcast, denying these rumors that he had met with a TNA executive, Dean, I forgot what his name is. Interestingly enough, he did not deny meeting the Carters. He just denied meeting this particular TNA executive. So I do believe that Jim Ross has met with the people at TNA. He may have even met with the people at HDNet. I don't know that Jim Ross would be broadcasting Ring of Honor, but HDNet has a lot of MMA programming, and JR has made no bones about the fact that he would love to do MMA announcing. You know, he's not going to do it in UFC because they already have their announce team set, but is it out of the realm of possibility that Jim Ross could leave WWE and end up doing as one of his many projects, announcing for a small mixed martial arts promotion? Sure. It could happen. But I don't see him going to TNA. That's not impossible, but just highly, highly unlikely. Heyman would be more likely, but I still don't think Heyman's going in either. And Jim Cornette has obviously burned his bridge with TNA, being that he essentially didn't really send death threats, but, you know, he obviously has had some not-so-nice things to say about Jim Cornette. He's certainly not going to be going back to TNA anytime soon. So if Russo steps away, who do you put in there? Who writes the shows? Is it Bischoff? Is it Hogan? I think Bischoff and Hogan enjoy contributing their own ideas. I don't see them wanting to actually script out these shows the way that Russo does. So if Russo steps aside, I think that would be great. I would applaud. But then it becomes a question of who do you replace him with? Because that is just as important. And if Heyman, for example, does not want the job, and let's say they promote from within, whoever they put in that spot, I really hope they know what they're doing. They had one good show this week. I need to see three in a row before I am confident that TNA is on the right track. So, Raw sucked this week. TNA was good. Bizarro world. Let's hope they can keep it up. WWE has their Extreme Rules pay-per-view this Sunday. Big matches of the evening will be John Cena and Batista, last man standing for the WWE Championship. We have Jack Swagger defending his World Heavyweight Championship against Randy Orton. We have Triple H and Sheamus in a street fight, I believe. I don't have it in front of me. I had it open. I closed it. I'm going by memory here. I know there's some sort of what they're calling an extreme makeover match, because every match on this show has to have a stip involving, I believe, Michelle McCool and one of the other divas from SmackDown. What else do we have? Let's see. Extreme Rules. I got to bring it up. Edge and Chris Jericho, yes. Inside of a steel cage. CM Punk and Rey Mysterio. If Mysterio wins, Punk has to have his head shaved. I don't see that happening. JTG and Shad Gaspard in a strap match. And that's pretty much it. Those are your main matches for the pay-per-view on Sunday. Not a buy for me. Probably not a buy for many of you. Speaking of buys, I should say that the WWE put tickets on sale this morning for their Fatal 4-Way pay-per-view, which I still maintain is a shitty, shitty, shitty pay-per-view name and a shitty, shitty pay-per-view concept, but it is still a WWE pay-per-view that I know for a fact I would not even consider ordering on pay-per-view. However, I would buy a ticket to the show if it came to my town, because I've been to pay-per-views before, and it's always a fun time, even for an average show. You will always have a good time if you go live to see a WWE pay-per-view. So, they're coming to the Nassau Coliseum in Long Island, not far from where I am here in New York. Tickets go on sale. I decide, you know, my friend would like to go sit floor, ringside, whatever, at the pay-per-view. Let's see how much these tickets cost. So, they come up. Actually, I got the code for the pre-sale on Wednesday, so I figured, ooh, this will be good. Put the code in, bring up the results on Ticketmaster, and sure as shit, they have section 6F, which is on the floor, not far from the ring. It's at one of the front rows in the section, row B or whatever it was. Seats 3 and 4. And I look at the price tag, and it's $400 per ticket. Now, I know that there are people listening to this podcast who are probably doing pretty well for themselves, and some of you are probably still in school, so it pretty much runs the gamut of the people we have listening to this show. If I made $1 million per year, I still don't think I would spend $400 on a ticket to a Fatal 4-Way pay-per-view. Who in their right mind would spend that kind of money for most pay-per-views? At least for WrestleMania, I can understand. Fatal 4-Way? Really? Thank you, no. So, I figured that was the end of that. And then this morning, they had the actual on sale for the public. I happened to be up. I think I woke up about 10 minutes before 10 a.m., which is when tickets went on sale. So I thought, all right, let's go on and see what we can get. Fuck my friend. Maybe my brother will go. We'll go together. I don't mind if I sit close to the ring. If I have decent seats that aren't far away, I'm a happy guy. And sure enough, pretty good seats came up in the loge area. And for $50, which is more in my price range. So, I scooped them up. I'll be going to the Fatal 4-Way pay-per-view on June 20th. And it's almost 2 years to the month that I was last at the Nassau Coliseum in Long Island for a WWE pay-per-view, which ironically was the very last Great American Bash, as it was called, Great American Bash pay-per-view. So, this will be the first Fatal 4-Way pay-per-view, so a little bit of history there. If it turns out to be a great show, great. If it turned out to be an average show at best, I'll probably still have fun. And since I cashed in my American Express rewards points, the tickets are really only costing me about $15 each. So let's be honest, you can't really go wrong. So I won't be checking out Extreme Rules, but I will be checking out Fatal 4-Way in June. I just thought that I would throw that out there. And of course, I will have a very interesting live report on the podcast a week after, but that's 2 months away, so we'll talk about that later on. Raw, this Monday night, a three-hour draft special. Lots of rumors and speculation about who's going to go where. Usually they like to make at least one or two big splashes. Here's the deal. Nobody knows who's going where because they're probably not even done booking the draft. But my picks, if I had to pick who's going to go where, I'll throw a couple of names out there. Chris Jericho and Edge. Just the fact that they're putting them in a cage on pay-per-view this Sunday tells me that I think they're wrapping up that program, which means one or the other is going to have to switch brands. And I'd love to see Jericho back on Raw, but since he just came from Raw, I think there's a much better chance of Edge switching over to the Raw brand. If that happens, my hope would be that Christian is not, in fact, drafted to SmackDown. I maintain that when ECW died, I wanted Christian to go to SmackDown because I felt it would be better for him, and I still think it would be better for him. But if Edge goes to Raw selfishly, I would hope that Christian stays just because it would almost force them at some point to do something with the two of them. For years they teased us, and it took them how many years since Shawn Michaels came out of retirement to give us that Shawn Michaels Undertaker interaction. So it's been far too long. I think the time has come. Put Edge and Christian together. I don't mean put them back in a permanent tag team, but to see them do some tag matches together, and maybe even Christian goes heel. I think he works better as a heel and maybe feud with Edge, or maybe the other way around. Either way, selfishly, I'd love to see them on the same brand. So Edge to Raw. Christian hopefully will stay where he is. Randy Orton, I could very easily see going to SmackDown. Maybe John Cena. Again, I can't see Orton and Cena being on the same brand. So it's going to be one or the other. And I still find it very, very hard to believe that they would move Orton, move Cena, which is possible. But I'm going to go with Randy Orton being the one to switch. Triple H, of course, that's funny. He's paid his price. He's been drafted to SmackDown before. I don't see that happening again. Rey Mysterio could very easily be moved to Raw. Him being on SmackDown to cater to the Hispanic market and the Hispanic demographic isn't really going to make a damn bit of difference once that show moves off my network to Sci-Fi this fall, which is where SmackDown is moving. And surprisingly enough, still on Friday nights. These people just don't learn. Friday night is one of the worst fucking nights of the week to have a TV show, if not the worst. Why they would keep SmackDown on Friday nights is beyond me. I have heard nothing that suggests that the decision was not theirs to make. It's kind of like when Impact moved to Monday nights. They moved from 9 to 11. And Dixie did a press conference with Hulk Hogan and was asked by a member of the media, why 9 to 11? And Dixie made it clear, this was our decision. We had a choice. We opted for 9 to 11. Of course, now we sit here and Impact has moved to 8 to 10, which is where they should have been in the first place. So on the flip side of that, you have SmackDown, which years ago was forced, I believe they were forced, to move to Friday nights. It was not a decision they were happy with, and their audience did take a bit of a dip. Why they are staying on Friday nights is just mind-blowing to me. And I read, I don't remember where I read it, but the person made a very good point. Vince McMahon is so big, he has a big hard-on advertising and all that. It's much easier for them to advertise new movies that are coming out on a Thursday night because most new movies come out on Friday as opposed to having a Friday broadcast. That's just one of 15 different reasons I could give why they should move SmackDown to Friday nights. I'll give you one right now. Most of the time, I'm not home on Friday nights. I'd like to watch SmackDown more often. I don't have DVR. VHS is a dying breed. I can watch clips on YouTube. I actually did watch SmackDown this week, but most weeks I just can't. Friday night is a bad, bad night. Anyway, what I hope this means is that SmackDown moving to Sci-Fi doesn't make WWE think, well, this show is a lost cause, and they do what they did a couple of years ago and just put all the big names on Raw. SmackDown has to come out of this draft with at least one big name. Orton may be that name, maybe Cena. But they're going to have a couple of big pieces because when they make the shift to Sci-Fi, they have to give people a reason to watch. And I believe that change is taking place either in October or November. So, it seems far away. Really, it's not. So we'll see. Announcers could be drafted. I've got my fingers and my toes crossed that Michael Cole gets drafted not only off Raw but out of the WWE. I don't even know who they would replace him with. I don't care. Replace him with dead air. It doesn't make sense. It doesn't matter to me at all. Doesn't make sense to keep him on that show. He clearly, in my opinion, he's a good announcer, but he brings Raw down. It's been a fun experiment for WWE. Yeah, the fans have had so much fun listening to Michael Cole. June of 2008 is when he moved to Raw. Think about that. Almost 2 years of Michael Cole on Monday nights. The experiment is over. Let's just hope. I don't know who they would replace him with. Probably not going to happen. Let's hope. So anyway, those are my thoughts on the draft. SmackDown, by the way, moving to Sci-Fi basically means the end of NXT. There is some hope that NXT may be salvaged for another season if a network like Bravo were to pick them up. But if they don't, they can go one of two ways. They could kill NXT, which is a distinct possibility. Or they can make it a web-only series on WWE.com, which, of course, will fail miserably because, as we've seen in the past, web-only TV content just doesn't work. If you're really counting on an audience finding that show, they're just not going to. It's not going to happen. So NXT may be in its dying days, although, you know, if they decide, you know what, we think that these rookies got a lot out of this show, and even if a lot of people don't watch it, it's still worth doing, then great. They could put it on the website, and they can continue NXT. But I just think it's unlikely, unless they find a TV network that wants it. Now, I've had people email me and go, well, why wouldn't they move SmackDown, for example, to USA? Keep NXT on Sci-Fi. You know, why? Oh, they're so stupid. WWE is being stupid for not moving SmackDown to Thursdays, but they're not stupid for moving it to Sci-Fi because USA Network does not want more wrestling. USA Network is, I think, the number one network on cable. They're always in direct competition with TNT for that top spot. Raw really helps them a lot, but they don't want to be known as the wrestling network. So they've got Raw. And they've got AM Raw, which is late night on Saturday nights. They don't want any more wrestling than that. That's a decision they made. And there's no other network out there that wants wrestling right now. Sci-Fi decided to take it. This will help Sci-Fi. Believe me, it will help Sci-Fi. So don't blame WWE for that. USA just did not want the show. It's as simple as that. Otherwise, they would have moved it there. And remember, they're working on a 24-hour cable network. They're moving ahead. You know, they just hired, I think, 35 people to work in their video department to go through their entire videotape library and make sure everything is good quality and organized correctly and up to speed and up to date for when they launch the network. And Vince McMahon is aiming to launch the network at the end of 2011. So they're moving ahead on that. And for them, it's good because if one day, let's say, the wrestling bubble has burst, their contract is up with USA, Bonnie Hammer, who was, I think, the head of programming, who loves the wrestling product and is good friends with the McMahons, let's say she moves up or she leaves the company and is no longer in power and somebody comes in like WCW in 2001, they don't like wrestling and they cancel it. At least if WWE has their own network, they'll have some place to go. If for no other reason, that's one good thing about them doing a 24-hour network. Of course, there's also a lot of potential bad things about that, but we don't have to get into that right now. So that's the TV situation. I just wanted to address that because people are very quick to blame the company and a lot of times they're right for doing that, but this is not one of those times. USA just did not want another wrestling show. It's as simple as that. Now, I had a lot of people email me as well about this new TNA ranking system. Of course, I've been a big proponent of there being a ranking system, not just in TNA, but even in WWE, for the titles. I think I talked about this a lot, and actually it's been a while since I have, so a lot of the people that emailed me obviously are long-time listeners to this podcast. I think my original idea was to have some sort of power ranking system where for the world titles in WWE, you know, the world title and the WWE title on each brand, you would have a top 10 list of contenders. For every other title, you can make it a top 5. And you would try as much as possible to stick to those rankings and make it as legit and feel as real as possible. Now, you can have matches now and every now and then that are, you know, number one contender matches, you know, where the number two guy on the list maybe is willing to put his spot on the line against the number four guy. So somebody could leapfrog in certain situations. There's, you know, there's room for leeway. But by and large, I think having a ranking system that people could log on to WWE.com every week and check and talk about would be a cool concept. And I talked about that a long time ago. Now, I don't know that that's the format that TNA is going with here. From what I understand, I'll bring it up right here, actually. Dixie Carter tweeted. She loves doing that. And she had a tweet yesterday that said, quote, excited about the new ranking system that Eric Bischoff is going to reveal on Monday's Impact show. Your vote will count, end quote. So what that tells me right there is that there's going to be some interactive features, which could be good or it could be very bad. You know, WWE did the interactive pay-per-views for a couple of years, and at first it was kind of a novelty. It was a cool concept, and then after a while we found out that it was kind of stupid. It didn't really matter. So I don't know what their system is going to be like. We'll find out, I guess, this Monday night. I didn't read anything about it at all during the, you know, in spoilers. So maybe it's some sort of backstage segment or a pre-tape that they're going to insert into the show where Eric Bischoff explains how it works. But I think any ranking system is a cool concept. So again, it's another sign that maybe TNA is smartening up a little bit. Maybe they are headed in the right direction. And this is something that I think WWE could borrow from, quite frankly. It doesn't have to be my exact idea. There's a lot of different types of ranking systems, a lot of different criteria that you could go with. But I think it makes a lot more sense to have something like that than just randomly picking people out of your ass. You know, 1 week, somebody's got a title shot, and you scratch your head and you say, wait a minute, this guy's a mid-card guy. He hasn't won a match in 2 months. Why is he getting a title match? Well, because he walked up to the champion and he issued a challenge. And I think that's stupid. If it's that easy, what's stopping Joe Blow from getting a title shot every single week? So, thumbs up on the rankings concept, but I will reserve judgment until I hear exactly how it's going to work. Raw, coming to Canada, finally, May 17th in Toronto. And from what I understand, Bret the Hitman Hart may be there. WWE may be preparing to make that a big show that is highlighted by Bret Hart's return to Canada on TV. For all the weeks that Bret was on Raw leading up to WrestleMania, they never once had a Canadian show booked, which was kind of a shame. And, of course, Bret... Now, I don't know if he's under a new deal. I think he's probably just on some sort of temporary deal or maybe even a verbal deal with WWE. He was on the European tour. He was a special enforcer for some matches. He put Chris Jericho in a sharpshooter one night. So he's still – and obviously he's on Raw. He's doing an angle now with Show Miz and the Hart Dynasty trying to help his nephew out, his nephews and nieces and whatnot, which is cool. So I think I think it would be fantastic. I think even though the bloom is somewhat off the rose, Bret's been back for a couple of months now, him walking out there, his music hitting and walking out there in Canada would be huge. And it looks like May 17th in Toronto, they may be building for a big Bret Hart return in Canada. So we'll see what happens. Hopefully they do. And, you know, he'll be able to get a hero's welcome in his home country. Of course, he was supposed to be on Raw this past Monday night to tell the world that Show Miz is, in fact, the greatest tag team in history. And that did not happen because Show Miz and Bret were both stranded in Europe. I would imagine that they will do it this Monday on Raw, but that has not yet been announced. So we shall see. And by the way, now that I think about it, if Bret is sticking around and if he is going to give the rub to the Hart Dynasty, it would probably make sense to have the Hart Dynasty formally drafted from SmackDown to Raw this Monday night. Because I don't see Bret appearing on SmackDown every week. If they want Bret on Raw, May 17th being a prime example of why, I think it would make sense to move Harry Boy and Tyson Kidd this Monday night. So that'd be another prediction of mine. Let's go with the Hart Dynasty moving over to the Raw brand. I certainly would not mind that. All right, let's get to the mailbag here. This poor mailbag, it's collected dust. It's been sitting here for 2 weeks now. It's time to open up this bad boy. All right. Now, I want to thank everybody who wrote in and did, in fact, listen to my plea on the last show, and they put at the beginning of the email how long they've been listening for, since what episode. It's just kind of cool to see who the diehards are and who some of the newbies are. And I'll mention them when I read each letter, by the way. So let's get right into it here. This first one here comes from Patrick in New Zealand. Dear Solomonster, I've been a listener since episode 98, so a relatively new listener here. A couple of different questions. Let's just pick one here. Do you think The Undertaker will go 20-0 at WrestleMania? And if so, who do you think his last two Mania opponents will be? Well, impossible to tell. Certainly, John Cena, I maintained this before. I loved the fact that we got another Shawn Michaels Undertaker match. But before that, the original plan was for Undertaker to challenge Vince McMahon at WrestleMania. What a shitty match that would have been, as we saw from Vince's match, if you could call it that, with Bret Hart. So instead, we got another 4-star, maybe 5-star affair with Michaels and Undertaker. And I think that Undertaker is going to stick around long enough for 20-0 and maybe even go beyond that. I think it would be anticlimactic for him to end up going, for example, 19-0 and then to retire. Although maybe have Undertaker wrestle twice in one night. Who knows? I think John Cena will be an opponent of his before he calls it quits. Maybe his last opponent. I think it would be awesome because of the heat the match would generate. I mean, just think about it. You still have plenty of fans out there who boo John Cena. They do not like the sight of John Cena. And the prospect of Cena being the man to end the famed, undefeated streak of their beloved Undertaker at WrestleMania would rile these people up so much, you may have a Rock Hogan-esque reaction from the crowd during this match, just in terms of how passionate they are about it. So I think for that reason alone, it would be a great match. Triple H, you know, he fought the Undertaker at WrestleMania 17. Maybe he would want to avenge the loss of his friend Shawn Michaels, although I got to be honest with you, Triple H now is not the same Triple H from 10 years ago, and in many ways neither is the Undertaker, although the Undertaker still continues to amaze me, except, you know, Monday night he didn't look too good, but I don't know that I want to see another rematch. You know, we've seen Undertaker face Kane twice. We've seen Undertaker face Shawn Michaels twice back-to-back. I'd like to see two fresh opponents for the Undertaker, John Cena being one of them. So that would be my suggestion. Luis writes in, do you think that Jim Ross would or could legally put out a podcast online as an alternate audio track of him calling certain big matches that could be posted on his official website so the fans could listen to it as they're watching those matches? For example, Michaels Undertaker at this year's WrestleMania, Bret vs. Vince, Mick Foley winning the title from The Rock on Raw in January of 99, etc. And do you think this would disrespect the other announcers? That is, of course, from Luis in Aurora, Illinois. Well, it's not going to happen. Why would Jim Ross waste his time doing this? We know that Jim Ross wanted to call Michaels Undertaker this year. We know he wanted to call Bret and Vince. And yes, I think Ross calling that first Foley victory on Raw would have been fantastic. Michael Cole did an admirable job back in 99, but he was no Jim Ross then. He's no Jim Ross now. But I don't see why Jim Ross would want to waste his time. And I don't think he would be able to anyway. I mean, if you're talking about playing the audio from these matches with Ross's commentary over it, first of all, he'd have to work in cooperation with WWE on that project because they'd have to take out the commentary track that currently exists so that he can dub his own commentary over it. Not going to happen. They're not going to allow him to do that and put it for free up on his website, or certainly charge for it, let alone put it up for free up on his own website. So, he's not going to do it, and even if he wanted to, I don't think he could. Got a letter here from, I believe it's Michelle. Now, there's no T in there, so I didn't say Mitchell, so I hope I'm pronouncing that right. Michelle comes from England, writes in, loves the podcast. Thank you. You mentioned The Undertaker hobbling around backstage and Jeff Hardy being in a bad way, and it got me thinking, Solomonster. Some of these wrestlers are my heroes, and I have so much respect for them and the hard job they do, but why are they really so beat up? I live in England here, and as soon as a professional soccer player twists an ankle, they take 6 months off. Why can't wrestlers do the same? I really don't like the thought that some of my heroes are having to work while they are in so much pain. What are your thoughts? Surely their short careers must be related to this injury and non-rest policy. Well, there is no written official policy that says you cannot take time off for an injury. And in fact, publicly, WWE encourages its talent to let them know when they're hurt so they could take time off as needed. However, there is an unwritten, I can't even say a rule, but there is an unwritten policy in professional wrestling that says if you are hurt and it is not life-threatening or career-threatening, suck it up and move on. Now, maybe that's more of an old-school mentality, and you see less of it nowadays, but it still exists. The mindset of wrestlers is that if I get hurt and I take time off for any length of time, whether it's a few weeks or several months, I run the risk of losing my spot to somebody else. If I'm getting a push, and wrestling is a very fickle business, when you get an opportunity, you have to be prepared to take it. And I completely understand that mindset if I'm a wrestler. I'm getting a push. I'm doing well for myself. Now I just twisted my ankle, tore a ligament. I really should probably just rest up for 6 weeks. But I know that if I take 6 weeks off, first of all, there are going to be people in the company who look at me in a different way, for better or worse. Unfortunately, there are those people who work for the company, some agents and even other talent, who will look at that and think that somebody is soft, that they're not tough. And on top of that, if you take 6 weeks off, there's a pretty good chance that somebody else is going to be slotted into your spot against whoever you were married to, quote-unquote, in that particular program. And when you come back, that spot's not going to be there waiting for you. You may not have another opportunity. You may find yourself on the cut list next time, like Shelton Benjamin and Mickey James and Funaki. So that's the reason why they don't do it. I mean, believe me, if that was not the case in pro wrestling, people would take time off for injuries. But this is the mentality that exists. I don't agree with it. I don't like it, but that's just the way it is. Russell writes in, awful as it seems, you have to admit that that was probably the most beautiful moonsault ever by Kurt Angle. I assume that what Russell is referring to is the moonsault that Angle gave to Mr. Anderson in their cage match at Lockdown, which I have not seen, but I have not heard one bad thing except about the moonsault, which supposedly was incredibly crazy and Kurt Angle was incredibly stupid for doing. That aside, from what I understand, they had a phenomenal four-star match, so I am anxious to see it from the Lockdown pay-per-view. I did see a clip on YouTube of the Kurt Angle moonsault from a fan cam, and it was just, it's insane. I mean, that is a move that is insane for anybody to take, but for Kurt Angle, a man who is in constant pain, has as fucked up a neck as anybody you will find in the wrestling business, among other nagging injuries, I assume that he no longer does. At one point, he certainly did have an addiction to pain medication. For him to be doing a moonsault off the top of a cage, that is the exact same move, by the way, that he did in that cage match on Raw in 2001 with Chris Benoit, where I think he blew out his knee. And Benoit, of course, did a diving headbutt from the top of the cage. And as we saw what the likely end result of all those years of diving headbutts was for Chris Benoit. So I don't like seeing that. It's just unnecessary for Kurt Angle to do it. I mean, I went to a live TNA show here in New York. They came to New York City once. February of 2008, they came to Webster Hall, okay, which is a dance hall. And they set up a wrestling ring. I had VIP seats. It was a great time. I got to meet Kurt Angle. I got to talk to him a little bit. He's got that glazed over look in his eyes all the time. It's scary. And Kurt Angle wrestled Christian Cage for the TNA title in the main event. Kurt was the champion at the time. This ring was the tiniest fucking ring I have ever seen in my life. I assume it's a special ring they send on house shows for certain locations. This was not the standard size of a TNA ring. It was tiny. And even in this tiny ring where they barely had enough room to move, Kurt Angle did a moonsault. And his legs almost hit the ropes on the way down. I thought it was stupid for him to do that moonsault then. Then I see this. So he may have had a phenomenal match with Mr. Anderson, but again, if I'm Kurt Angle, you know what? Leave the stupid shit to the younger guys. You know? I mean, you don't have to be doing that to yourself. Come on. Jamie writes in, Dear Solomonster, have you ever been involved in pro wrestling shows in any form in terms of being a performer, a promoter, a booker, etc.? And if not, then why not? I'm going to say no comment on that question and move on. How's that? Sean writes in, Solomonster, longtime follower of your podcast. My first time sending into the mailbag. Well done on 100-plus podcasts. So thank you very much. Let's see here. He's got a YouTube video link here to some film regarding the Hulk Hogan-Jeff Jarrett Bash at the Beach 2000 match. I guess that whole Russo incident, was this in fact a work? Yes and no. The Hogan thing at Bash at the Beach 2000, just to make a long story short, the idea was that they would pretend that it was a shoot, and Jeff Jarrett would lay down for Hulk, and Hulk would pretend that he didn't know what was going on, and he'd win the belt, and then Russo would come out later and make some comments. That was the plan. And what ended up happening was Russo came out, and he just completely shot all over Hulk Hogan for real. He called him a bald son of a bitch, selfish, this and that. He took it to the extreme, and Hulk Hogan was not happy, stormed out, filed a lawsuit. That part was not a work. That was very much real. So it was a little bit of both. Mostly a shoot, but it was basically a work that went awry is what happened there, which, you know, time heals all wounds, but it just makes me that much more surprised that Hogan was willing to at least work with Russo and he didn't get rid of him right away when he came into TNA. So that's the story behind that. And I don't think the lawsuit that Hogan filed ever went anywhere. He filed suit for defamation and whatnot, but I don't know that the lawsuit ever really went anywhere. All right. Dear Solomonster, this comes from Brett. Thank you for posting a vintage podcast in your absence. That's right. For those of you who were not aware, because I didn't post this on the main SE Scoop site, I did post it on my Twitter when I was gone. Just before I left, I uploaded a classic episode of the podcast, episode 30 from, I believe it was June 22nd, 2008, which ironically was just before the WWE draft. That would have been the draft where Jim Ross went to SmackDown and Michael Cole went to Raw. That's still up. I'm going to keep that up for a little while longer. So go to my Twitter page, twitter.com/Solomonster. You're going to have to scroll back a little bit from just before I left for my trip. Or if you go to, you know, it's in the iTunes store. It's in the feed that we have. And you can download episode 30 from there if you have not done so already. Anyway, Brett goes on here. I've been listening to your show now for over 2 years and didn't realize it had been that long. I've been a fan since podcast 21. Well, thank you. My question this week is about The Rock. How amazing, funny, and great was The Rock? He was amazingly great. How's that for an answer? Actually, short, easy questions. I like that. Rock was awesome. Craig from Texas writes in, Dear Solomonster, I was wondering what you think about SmackDown moving to Sci-Fi. In my opinion, this will have some backlash on their viewership. Also, to answer a couple of questions from your recent shows, I watch less wrestling than I do your podcasts. I find more entertainment from said podcast over what is broadcast on TV. I've been following you for over a year. Thanks for your effort. Well, thank you. As far as backlash from the viewers, it doesn't really matter. Like I said, they didn't have a choice. They chose not to go with my network because they could see the writing on the wall. My network is likely not even going to be a network in the very near future. And nobody else wanted SmackDown. So what are you going to do? Put it on the website? They had no choice but to go to Sci-Fi. Unfortunately, if you have fans out there who still don't have cable TV, yeah, sucks for them because they won't be able to watch SmackDown except maybe on Hulu. But it really was not a decision that they had a lot of leeway in. They made the decision they felt they had to make. Sci-Fi is available in, I think, over 90 million homes, so most people will still be able to watch it. And that's really all there is to it. I don't see where the backlash is coming from. If people are upset about this, you know, they can hoot and holler all they want to, but WWE really didn't have a lot of options here. Dear Solomonster, comes from Jason. I listened to the live broadcast you did with Noah Mark a couple of weeks ago and had a question about Matt Hardy. You said Matt Hardy is his own worst enemy for not being champion for as long as he's been there. What is it that you know or believe is his reasoning other than the lack of mic skills for him not to have become champion yet? And what's the difference between him not being champ and another guy who's been there for years not being champ, such as Christian? Love the show. Hope your trip was fun and safe. Well, the thing with Christian, when Christian left WWE to go to TNA several years back, he had a meeting with Vince McMahon before he left to talk about his spot, things he was unhappy with, and Vince McMahon told Christian point blank, I don't see you as a main event guy. And that was all Christian needed to hear for him to leave. Now, obviously, he had enough of TNA, went back to WWE, and sure enough, Christian still has not been world champion, he's not been WWE champion, he's been ECW champion, and that belt meant shit. Now, it was an honor, I'm sure, for Christian to be given the responsibility of being the head guy for a brand, but it was for a brand that ultimately died, and we knew that eventually that would happen. To me, until Christian holds a world title, like on SmackDown or the WWE Championship, it will be apparent to me that Vince McMahon's feelings have not changed. I still enjoy Christian's work. I still think eventually he will get there. Matt Hardy, on the other hand, what do I mean when I call him his own worst enemy? Matt Hardy. Well, first of all, I don't want to talk about the guy's physique too much because, you know, it's hard for anybody to get their body into good shape. You know, Matt Hardy used to have a better physique than he has now. Would we all agree on that? He walks around now, maybe his belt's too tight. He's got a gut that hangs over. He doesn't look physically to be in the shape that he used to be in. Now, was it because, this is all speculation on my part. Now, was it because he was doing things back then that he is no longer allowed to do and therefore his body looks more natural? I don't know. Maybe. You know, the guy's had a bunch of injuries. He's had a couple of surgeries. Maybe that has something to do with it. Maybe in 6 months, if he works at it, he'll look like a new man. That's part of it. But that's only part of it. That's only a small part. Matt Hardy has a lot of fans. He does. He has a lot of followers on Twitter, people that follow his blogs, on MySpace. He has a huge fan following. There's no doubt about that. And he has this thing called the Matt Hardy Show, or I think it's actually just called the Hardy Show, which is just a side project that he does with his brother Jeff and some of his friends like Hurricane Helms and Shannon Moore and Chemo, who's somebody who's never been in WWE, but they've got this show. They've created their own show of them fucking around, horsing around in North Carolina, on the road. They sell DVDs of it. I think it's HardyShow.com or something like that. Go check it out. You can find it on YouTube as well, okay? He does all these different things. Matt is a very smart guy. He is. And I think one day Matt Hardy will be a very critical, you know, backstage influence for a wrestling company. I think maybe not as a booker, maybe as a writer. I don't know. I think in a backstage capacity, he can be very valuable. As a wrestler, he's very good. He's not great. He's very good. The reason that they're very hesitant to get behind him is because he has a big mouth. If you, even today, this morning, I read tweets that he posted overnight that just made me shake my head. He has a tendency to make comments that can be taken the wrong way by the wrong people. Even if he doesn't mean what he's saying, and I think he does sometimes. I think he gets frustrated at the fact that he's not pushed, that he does a lot of jobs. I mean, look at the way he was treated on SmackDown this week. They had to stop, call the match off because he got kicked in the head, he was beaten down, he was made to look like a jobber. And I can totally understand him being frustrated with that, but he has to understand how to play the game. Again, it's not right. Just like the mentality of, oh, I have to work so I don't lose my spot even if I'm hurt. It's not right, but that's the way it is. You've got to learn to play the game. And for a guy that has worked in that company since 1997, and even before that, him and Jeff were doing job and squash matches, but I think they got their first contract in 97. That's when they started consistently appearing on television as characters. 1997! He still has not learned. And it goes back to the stuff with Kane and Edge and Lita. Remember that whole storyline in 2004, 2005? You remember that? When the Edge and Lita stuff went down? Matt went on the internet and made a jackass out of himself. I agreed with most everything he said. If I was in Matt's position and my girlfriend was fucking around with another wrestler who was a friend of mine, I'd be pissed too. I would want to beat the shit out of that person. But I would not go on the internet and do some of the things that I did. He went on the internet. He made these absurd comments. I remember one Hardy show in particular. He did a reenactment. It was very well done. It looked like a reality show. I mean, the production was very well done. He did a reenactment of the night that he found out. You know, the night that he discovered the voicemails from Adam Copeland on his girlfriend's phone. It was hilarious. I have a copy of it. I'm going to have to put the audio on here one day. But hilarious to watch. Incredibly stupid to post that on the internet. This is not the type of distraction that Vince McMahon and WWE want to have. He'll go on the internet. He'll make stupid comments. If he's not being pushed, he'll tell fans, you know, support me, come to the event, say this, chant that, do that. And inherently, there's nothing wrong with that. And if I was running WWE, I wouldn't have a problem with that. I would want somebody like Matt Hardy to get his fans more engaged. But you have to understand something. That is not the way that Vince McMahon and WWE views things. They view things like that as a distraction, and they want to minimize the distraction. They're not going to reward that type of behavior, and they're not going to go, you know what? I like this Matt Hardy guy. I think we're going to put the world title on him. To them, it's a joke. And it's funny because for as much money as WWE likes to think they make off the internet and all the money they try to make off the internet, a lot of people in that company are still stuck in 20 years ago. And they look at the internet as nothing more than a collection of dorks and marks and geeks. And they mock it. And to them, Matt Hardy is the uber internet nerd. Because he's always on there, he's always talking to his fans, he's on Twitter, he's on MySpace, he's doing all this stupid shit in their mind. And that's why he'll never get above a certain level. It's never going to happen. Matt Hardy's one of those guys who would benefit from just keeping his mouth shut, disappearing off the face of the earth, off the face of the internet earth for 3 months, cutting his hair, dropping a couple of pounds, and coming back on TV a new man. I think he needs to cut his hair. I've said that for a long time to friends of mine, but it's time to just make a change. And he just doesn't seem to want to do that. And that's why he will never get above a certain level. And I'm not saying this is a Matt Hardy hater. This is the way things are. You have to play the game. If you don't want to play the game, don't complain. Just do your job, enjoy your spot. You're never going to get higher than that. And go about your business. And I know he's got to be frustrated. A lot of people email me, oh, why do you think Matt Hardy is jobbed out this way? I mean, there's a reason for it. It may not make sense to you or me, but I at least understand why it's being done. Because this is how the company operates. The company that he has worked for his entire adult life, and he still does not get it. That's why. Worldwide Wonder wrote in, he attached some pictures of him at WrestleMania. Really cool stuff. Thanks for sending that in. One of his questions, of course, has been a lot of talk about Goldberg in negotiations, which he is. They've stalled recently, but he is in talks with WWE to do something, some sort of Legends or merchandising deal, which could be parlayed into maybe a WrestleMania appearance in Atlanta next year. Maybe even a Hall of Fame induction. His question, do I think Goldberg vs. Undertaker is a viable match for WrestleMania 27? Anything's possible. I think that's a big money match right there. But you have a problem in that Goldberg is not somebody that's going to easily just roll over and die. I don't know that Goldberg is going to be overly receptive to the idea of, hey, how about you come back? You haven't wrestled in all these years. It's Atlanta, you know, where you won your WCW championship back in 98. A lot of fans there. Why don't you sign with us? Come to WrestleMania so you can do a job to The Undertaker. I don't know that he would want to do that. I know on his Twitter, he said the two guys that he never got to work with in WWE that he really would like to are Undertaker and Austin. And Austin is never going to happen. Undertaker, if he wants to work with him that badly, if they could reach a deal, it's possible. I just do not see that happening at all. Because I just don't see Goldberg being receptive to the idea of coming in and jobbing. There's no way he's coming in to beat The Undertaker and end the streak. I mean, that would be... I don't need to tell you how dumb that decision would be. So it's just politically a tough kind of a tough mine. It's like stepping on a landmine, you know. I don't know that they need that type of headache in booking The Undertaker with an opponent. They'd be safer booking Goldberg if they were going to put him in a match with somebody who doesn't have, for example, an 18-0 undefeated streak on the line. So that's my thoughts. I do see Goldberg at WrestleMania next year. I think it's going to happen. I think he will wrestle. But I'm not convinced that it's going to be against The Undertaker. All right. Ryan wrote in, by the way, and just wanted to point out that Gene Konitsky, famous wrestler, passed away this past week at the age of 81. I had meant to mention that earlier. I did not. So I just wanted to get that out of the way right now. You know, it's a shame whenever anybody passes away. It just seems like in the last couple of months, we've had so many of these that we've had to report on. You know, Dr. Death was another one. Jack Briscoe, now this. It's just a shame. Matt from New York writes in, Dear Solomonster, do you think there is an employee in WWE headquarters assigned to staying up to date with the quote-unquote wrestling dirt sheets so that WWE creative can learn how they can swerve us? Do you think they listen to other wrestling shows and podcasts, including The Sound Off, as part of this employee's assignment? Everybody in the world thinks that WWE eavesdrops and listens to what they have to say. I go to wrestling message boards, you know, where people are just convinced that there is a WWE employee that gets paid to sit in a room and just troll the boards every day. And then when they start seeing some of their ideas on TV, they're convinced that WWE stole those ideas from them. All I can tell you is this. I don't know. I know they have people who do put together reports and keep track of the dirt sheets like the Wrestling Observer newsletter and the Torch and certain other websites. That I know for a fact. Do they have other people who listen to certain wrestling podcasts and go to some of the smaller websites? I think that they have employees that check everything out. Does that include this podcast? I don't know. I don't think so. But who knows? If they've delegated one or two people with that responsibility, they probably go to every single site in existence and check for any little thing that they're looking for. I don't work in that particular division of WWE New Media, so I can't say for sure. But I could tell you with absolute certainty that at the very least, they do check out some of the bigger newsletters and dirt sheets that have been around for years and years and years that Vince McMahon himself quite frankly, used to read and now claims he doesn't anymore. But beyond that, who knows? And second question here, did I ever call into Mean Gene's WWF or WCW hotline? If so, what was it like? Can't say that I did. Jimmy writes in, Dear Solomonster, I was at the SmackDown tapings on Tuesday at the Mohegan Sun, but I was not in the crowd. I was up in the concession stand selling food to hungry wrestling fans. That night, I saw at least six or seven grown men with championship belts, and even a woman, rocking the women's title. Well, I've ranted on that before. At least with women, I don't know. I guess I can excuse it. There's just no excuse for grown men walking around with championship belts. There's just, do it in your own home. Lord knows I've done it. But why would you bring it to a wrestling show? Maybe they bought it there. Even so, it's just stupid to me. Anyway, with there being a supplemental draft on Wednesday, do you think we will see a drastic change in the two rosters? Personally, I think they will just move the star powers to Raw from Raw and SmackDown and move some of the upper mid-card guys as well. I think you're pretty much dead on. There'll be a couple of big names that move. The supplemental draft is just their way of taking the mid-card and just shaking it up a bit. It'll pretty much be business as usual. And that'll be, you know, again, I can't get that excited about the draft because we see Raw and SmackDown guys on each show all the time. And you know that even though at first after the draft they'll say, well, things are going to be separate and they're going to be exclusive. You know, within a couple of weeks, it's going to be right back to the way it was, with guys popping up wherever they want. It doesn't make a difference. It means nothing. But it'll be a fun night of wrestling, 3-hour Raw this Monday night, so we'll see what they have up their sleeve. All right, last letter here for this week. This comes from Ant, who writes in with a case of the Cena flu. Here's Solomonster. I'm writing in to ask your opinion on John Cena and his whole character. Cena's been in WWE for about 8 years now, and it's obvious he's done very well for himself. The one thing that concerns me is that despite the fact that he is WWE champ, what does he really offer these days? When he first arrived, it took him a while to find his niche, but when he did and started rapping on SmackDown, his stock began to rise. The rise continued, and 2 years later, he became champion. He moved over to Raw later that year, where he eventually the boos began to kick in. Even though this was happening, it was very entertaining, and actually booing John Cena became part of the show. Over the next 18 months, he was fun to watch because most fans wanted to boo him. However, fast forward to 2010, and we are getting from Cena what exactly? Same old scripted promos, catchphrases, gimmicks, and t-shirts. It's actually at the point, and has been for a while, that it's not worth booing Cena. He's just there every week doing the same old crap. I'd say for 2 years now, he's been going through the motions, and although I appreciate his company man attitude, I've owned blue stale bread that's got more freshness in it than him. Cena says, you can't see me. Well, I say, I can see you, and you look tired and unoriginal. I know it might seem like another anti-Cena rant, but it's more words of suffering. As many of the crowd signs have displayed, I've seen enough. What's your opinion on John Cena and a remedy to this problem? First of all, my first comment here, you own blue stale bread. See, normally when bread begins to get stale, I will see mold or white spots on it, and I'll know to get rid of it. I've never kept bread long enough where it gets to the point that it's actually turning blue. I just find that somewhat disturbing. But in all seriousness, my answer to that letter, which I thought was very thoughtful and well-written, and you make a lot of very valid points, and we all know the reason that Cena is still on top. He makes a lot of money, sells tickets, sells a lot of merchandise, but the very simple answer to your question, turn him heel. Turn him heel and put a suit on him. It's very simple. Go in the polar opposite direction of what the character represents right now. He comes out wearing jorts and a t-shirt and wristbands and a hat. He's smiling. He's happy-go-lucky. He's slapping hands with the kids. Go in the completely opposite direction. Turn him heel. Put him in a suit. No more smiles. That's about the only thing you could do, I think, to cut down on the staleness of Cena. It's just like Hogan. Hulk Hogan got stale. I didn't see it when I was a kid. I started to see it later on, but if somebody was my age back then, I could see where they would have been sick of Hulk Hogan just like they're sick of John Cena right now. And Hogan was stale right up until the day that he turned heel. Because no matter what he did as a babyface, he was still a babyface at the end of the day. And even if they gave him more of an edge, even if he changed his look, he still was going to be babyface Hulk Hogan. But when he turned heel in 96 and joined the NWO and started wearing all black and crapping on the fans, that's when the tide began to turn. And Hogan added another 5-10 years on his career because of it. Maybe not 10 years, more like 5 years. Cena just needs to go in the opposite direction, but he is content and WWE is content with maintaining the status quo because he's their spokesperson. He's the big baby face that the kids can get behind. He's selling the t-shirts and the merchandise. Why rock the boat? But that's about the only way that you're going to actually get him to not feel stale. Turn him heel, put him in a suit, let him loose. Don't script out his promos. He can talk. Let him talk. I think he would be phenomenal in that role. But it's just not in the plans, unfortunately. So that's going to do it for the mailbag this week. Fortunately, I'm going to have to leave out some of the letters. Maybe I'll be able to get to them next week, or I'll just email people individually if I have time. But I want to thank everybody who sent in a question or comment. And you can do the same, of course, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/solemonster, if you're not already doing so. We are up to about, I think, 473 followers at last count. And I'm thinking that maybe if we can get that number up to 500, if you are the 500th follower, maybe we'll try to get you on the podcast. Maybe we'll try to tape a little deal with you off the air and kind of insert it into an upcoming episode, and maybe I'll interview you. Do something fun. We'll do something special if you're follower number 500 on Twitter. There's a reason to follow the Solemonster. And, of course, you can download every single podcast through iTunes. You can subscribe and have these shows delivered to you automatically. If you are one of those people, by the way, then you were one of those people who was able to listen to Vintage Sound Off 30 that I posted 2 weeks ago. You never know when I may post another one, so definitely check that out. Now, before I leave here this week, I will give some thoughts on... actually, before I do that, I want to throw a quick shout-out here. A friend of mine has been training to become a professional wrestler. He's been a wrestling fan his whole life, and he made the decision that this was something he wanted to do. So he's giving it a shot. He's been training with the legendary Johnny Rods, who, of course, has trained other notables, including Taz and some others who escape me at the moment. And he will be having his first show. He will be participating in his first show. It will be at the world-famous Gleason's Gym in Brooklyn, New York, on Saturday, May 1st, bell time, 7:30 p.m. He'll be known as Amish Cousin Simon, who will be accompanying another Amish fellow of his to the ring. And as he just found out a couple of days ago, he will also be participating in a battle royal that night. How cool is that? Your first wrestling show, and you think you're just going to manage somebody in the ring, and then you find out that you're actually in a battle royal. May win the whole damn thing, too. So if you're in the area, if you want to get a ticket, you may do so. I believe the promotion, it's called WUW. I believe they have a website. I don't have the URL in front of me, but type in WUW and Johnny Rods and May 1st. I'm sure you'll find the results right away on Google. Check it out. Show your support. Should be a fun time. So with that out of the way, let me give some thoughts on my trip to Costa Rica before I leave here this week. And obviously I made it back in one piece. I survived. So in that respect, it was a great trip. And let me tell you, there were many instances where I thought I was not, in fact, going to make it. The reason being, I allowed a friend of mine to book this trip. The genesis of this whole thing is a friend of mine who loves to travel to different quirky places in the world decided that he wanted to go to Costa Rica. So he booked a deal through this company called Gate One Travel, which I've heard both good and bad things about. And they needed a fourth person. They asked me. I said yes, because it's been years since I've taken a vacation anyway, so why not? So we all go to Costa Rica. We get there. We land. And we land in the main city of San Jose. Now, San Jose, when you're driving down the streets, looks like any other major city. You know, it has a fair amount of traffic, but, you know, lots of stores and restaurants and places like that. And then you have the individual neighborhoods. You'll drive down these blocks where, in all honesty, it kind of scares you. Me, not so much, because I live in Brooklyn, and let's be honest, anybody that knows anything about Brooklyn, you've got your good parts of Brooklyn, and you've got your not so good parts of Brooklyn, just in terms of, you'll be driving down one block in Brooklyn that may look really, really nice, and then you could be in a completely different part of Brooklyn, where, you know, all the houses have bars on the windows, you know, and you could just tell that maybe this isn't the best place to be stuck in. So San Jose was kind of like that. I don't know that I was able to explore the entire city, but in certain parts that we were driving through, you would have these small, kind of rundown-looking houses that had bars in the windows and barbed wire in front of the house. And that's always one way to instill confidence in somebody, when you see barbed wire in front of the house. So we get there at night. We get to the hotel. The hotel is, you know, it's fine. I mean, it's nothing wrong with the hotel. I checked in advance. They were all at least three, if not four-star hotels. Nothing terribly fancy, but they weren't exactly a rat hole. So, you know, the first night that we're there, we don't exactly know where we want to go. We go to the hotel receptionist. What do you recommend? We just want to go to a bar. What place do you recommend? Oh, we know where you should go. We'll call a taxi. Now, mind you, we rented a vehicle. We rented which turned out to be a Beego, okay? I don't know if you've ever driven a Beego before. Wasn't familiar with Beego until this trip. Now, I know that in most countries, including Costa Rica, and probably many places in Europe, it is customary to drive a manual transmission vehicle, to drive stick. In the U.S., it's not common at all. Plenty of people do it, but by and large, you drive an automatic transmission. That's what I'm used to. That's what most people are used to. I don't know what happened. I guess it was part of the booking arrangement. But we were being given a manual transmission vehicle. And I told my friend, I said, look, when we get to the car rental place, let me talk to them. There's got to be, how much more expensive could it possibly be to rent a vehicle with an automatic transmission? And as it turns out, it only would have been an extra $20 or $30 a day. We were going to be there for a week. You know what? I would feel a lot safer if we just got the automatic transmission. So sure as shit, we asked for it, and they don't have one in stock. It would have been a day and a half, but we didn't have that time to wait. So we had to take the manual transmission. I've never driven manual. My friend's never driven manual. The other two schmucks on the trip who booked it, they were responsible for driving manual because we weren't going to do it. So it's always, again, a very good way to instill confidence when you're on the plane going to your destination and the designated driver for the trip is reading a how-to manual on how to drive manual transmission. So anyway, that was the first part of our adventure. I'll get to that in a second. But on this particular night, a taxi was called to take us to our destination. We didn't know where we were going. We just had told the woman in the hotel lobby, look, we want to go to a place where we can just go to a bar and drink and just have a little bit of fun. So we end up at this place called El Pueblo. Now, I'm sure that the few people who listen to the show who actually were very, very kind, and I communicated with them before my trip. They're from Costa Rica. They gave me tips and pointers on where to go and where not to go. I appreciate that. And they're probably familiar with El Pueblo. I was not. From what I understand, in the daytime, it's actually kind of a nice place to go to. It's hard for me to describe. It's not one, like, store or building. It's almost this place that you enter, like a parking lot, and then there's, it's like a series of shops that are kind of outdoors, and it's almost like this maze that you go through. It's very, I don't know, there's this old-fashioned feel to it. Well, at 11 o'clock at night, it was pretty desolate, and pretty much everybody sitting around there was eyeballing us. I mean, I thought we were going to die. You know, because, again, we're the outsiders here. And I don't mean Hall and Nash. And, you know, the taxi's pulled away, so we're pretty much on our own at this point. We go to enter, and the guy stops us, and he tells me to spread my shit. Again, great. Checking us for weapons, we're clean, they let us in. We're being stared down. Don't make eye contact, I told my friend. Just you know, the language barrier is there. If they think that we're, you know, trying to show them up and we're not, there's no way for us to communicate to them that we're really not. I really don't want to get killed. Let's just go about our business. We lasted all of, I don't know, 15 minutes there that night, and I said, we got to get the hell out of here. So that's what we did. So that was a fine first night introduction to Costa Rica. But I can say that aside from that, overall, it was a fun time. Driving around, there were no less than 15 different occasions where we were nearly killed on the road, thanks to my incompetent friends. Driving a manual transmission when you don't know what you're doing is quite adventurous. We must have stalled out at least 20 times over the course of this trip, at least. And when the car comes to a complete stop and you go to give gas, you're always going to go back a little bit. And that's fine if you're up in the mountains and there's not a lot of traffic. But I can tell you there were a couple of different times in Costa Rica where we're in the main city on a busy road and we come to a traffic light. And there's a person behind us just right up our ass. I mean, not giving us any room at all. And I thought for sure we're going to bump him. We're going to hit him. And by law down there, if you get in any sort of fender bender, no matter how big or small, by law, you have to get out of the car and leave it exactly where it is. Do not move it until the police arrive. I didn't want to have to go through that. So thankfully, we didn't bump anybody. We didn't hit anybody. We had a couple of close calls. It was interesting when we were heading to our third destination, which was up in the mountains. It's a place called Monteverdi, which, you know, it's really nice. A couple of small towns. It's just a completely different world. You know, a couple of little villages or whatever. And we would get to some very steep hills, which was very difficult to navigate in this car unless you were already going up at a great rate of speed, which oftentimes we were not. So in two particular instances, we just could not get over this fucking hill no matter how hard we tried. We stopped the car. There would be people coming by. We'd wave them to go in front of us. Again, not a busy road. So when they were gone, we had to back all the way down to the bottom of the hill just so we could build up enough momentum to get up over it. It was the most pathetic thing I think I've ever seen. And, of course, I'm in the back seat. So if we get hit in the back, I'm taking the brunt of that impact. You're basically driving on the edge of a cliff. There's no guardrails or anything. I mean, you can very easily look over the side and, you know, you go over the side, you're dead. That didn't faze me. It was stalling on those steep hills that got me very concerned. Driving in the main city, for example, let me tell you something. After this trip, I have an intense loathing for traffic roundabouts. And you can find these in most countries, okay, even in the U.S., when we were in San Jose, we must have hit a roundabout every 3 minutes. The GPS would chime, and a message would appear at the top that would say, roundabout coming up. And you'd get to this traffic roundabout. It's you know, a traffic circle, and you've got to work your way in there when there's no incoming traffic. And then you get into the circle, and then you take whatever exit you need to take to get out of the circle. It's very simple. And I just had visions dancing in my head of this fucking car stalling as we're pulling into the roundabout and just getting completely obliterated by a truck. There are many trucks and there are even more motorcycles in Costa Rica. I don't know why. I would imagine it's a way to save on money or gas. I don't know. Tons of motorcycles. Just tons of them. All over the place. So anyway, we didn't get killed in the car. I thought we would for sure. I did witness a traffic accident with my own eyes coming out of a souvenir shop, which was kind of fun. Nobody got hurt. It was the complete opposite of how it would have been handled in New York. You had a car that came to a stop sign at a main road, and the person started to drive and was making a left turn onto the main road, but there was somebody on the main road going straight who did not stop and clipped him right in the back and hit him pretty hard. And again, the car, one of the cars now is blocking the road. Can't move the car! By law, you got to leave it where it is. So the guy gets out of his car, he's laughing, he's smiling, the other guy gets out, he's smiling, is on his cell phone. Let me tell you something, if this was New York, it would have been a battle to the death in the middle of the street. But yet, people down here, very calm, very laid back. I will say that about the people of Costa Rica, their blood pressure has got to just dwarf what the blood pressure is for most people in New York City. I give them a lot of credit for that. I envy them for that. So that was an interesting experience. But on the flip side, waterfall rappelling. I mean, when are you ever going to have a chance in your life to do something like that? Zip lining, which I was told numerous times, you have to try it. I find myself zip lining over the rainforest, which is just, words can't describe how it is, how phenomenal it is. Thick fog. You cannot see in front of you. You're zip lining at 45 miles an hour. You cannot see shit in front of your eyes except a white cloud because of how foggy it was. Now, you can look down. You can look around. You see the treetops. And you're just waiting for the fog to clear and hoping that it doesn't clear late enough where you smash into a tree. That was fun. 13 different zip lines. A Tarzan swing at the end. I mentioned the waterfall rappelling. The last one that we did, we're wearing harnesses for this, and you're being lowered, and you're rappelling from, I think, a height of about 250 feet. And as somebody who is not exactly fond of heights, that was certainly an interesting experience. But it's one that I would do all over again if I could. If you're an adventurous person, if you're an outdoors person, if you like hiking, we did plenty of that. I'm not a big adventurer. I'm not a big hiker. But I did everything, and I enjoyed the hell out of it. And if you're one of these people who enjoys the outdoors and enjoys doing extreme things, I would recommend Costa Rica as a destination. It's a beautiful place. Plenty of different tours and things for you to do. We toured a coffee plantation to see how the coffee is made. We drank coffee and, you know, this person who was giving the tour, his aunt's house is right there. We went into her house. It was very, very nice. I learned that Starbucks, in fact, had just signed a contract with one of the many coffee plantations in Costa Rica to import coffee from Costa Rica that is used here in the States in Starbucks. I hate coffee. I don't like drinking it, so it doesn't matter to me. But if you are a Starbucks drinker, you might find that interesting. So anyway, really good time, really good people down there. I would definitely recommend it. And then we have the flight back. And by the end of this trip, I just want to go home. It's not that I just hated this place and had to get out of it. I just was ready. I was ready. I was ready to go home. I was more tired of my friends. You know, you go on vacation with your friends sometimes. By the end of that trip, you don't want to see these people again for 6 months. So I was pretty much at my wit's end by this point. We get to the airport. I got my passport. I'm making sure it gets stamped and everything I need to do is done. And I just keep thinking in my head, something's going to happen here. I feel like I missed something. I didn't do something. I didn't pay something or I didn't get the right stamp. But I get through security and customs and everything I need to get through. I get on the plane. I'm sitting in my seat. We're about ready to take off. Everybody's on the plane. Nobody is left to come on. And sure as shit, here come people on the plane. I don't know who they are. They're obviously airport workers or something. They weren't police. Some sort of security officers. And they're going seat by seat. And they're coming towards our section. We're in the middle of the plane here. And I think to myself, yeah, can't be for me. Stop thinking like that. Sure as shit, they come over to our row, they look in my seat, they look at me. Are you Solomonster? Now, they didn't say Solomonster. I'm just using that name. You Solomonster? Swear to God. Now I'm thinking to myself, I'm never getting home. I'm going to be stuck here for the rest of my life. And I say, yes, I am. Thinking they're going to take me off this plane for what reason, I don't know. Maybe they don't like the podcast. Maybe they're a John Cena fan or a Matt Hardy fan. I don't know. Apparently, and I didn't realize this, when I got in, my boarding pass, they're supposed to rip your boarding pass and then give you the ticket so you can go. They didn't rip my boarding pass, and I never realized it. So the guy looks at me, asks me what my name is. I tell him. He asks for my boarding pass. I give him the boarding pass. He rips it, gives it back, says, has a nice day, leaves the plane. Talk about a way, you know, I couldn't believe it. Everyone's looking at me like, what's up with this guy, you know? And it turns out my fucking ticket wasn't ripped. Gives it back to me. Pool of sweat pouring down my face here. So finally we take off. We actually got into Newark Airport in New Jersey a little earlier than expected. And all was well. My experience, aside from those few hiccups that I just documented, was a fine trip. And I'm already beginning to plan and plot what my next destination will be. I'd like to keep it domestic. I know plenty of people like to go to international places. And I've never been to the Caribbean and places like that. But I'm thinking Vegas. Keep it simple. There's one place I've never been before, believe it or not, who I think that would be a fine trip. And ironically, I think Vegas would be a longer trip than Costa Rica. It took 5 hours to get to Costa Rica. I think it would take at least that long, maybe 6 hours from New York, I believe it is, to get to Vegas. So, which is kind of funny to me. I can get to a foreign country quicker than I can to Las Vegas, but we'll see. Solomonster in Vegas sounds like a fine idea. And we'll see if that happens, maybe in the next year or so. But for all the people who emailed me and asked about my trip, I thank you for that. Hopefully that gave you a little bit of insight. Like I said, I would recommend it. If you're not into that type of stuff, it's still a beautiful place to visit. And, the people down there are really cool, really laid back, very welcoming. It would help to speak Spanish. You would think that it would have been easy for me since I took Spanish for 6 years in school. I am not conversational in it, unfortunately, at all. So that just made things all the more adventurous. But what are you going to do? So, with that being said, we're going to call it quits here, episode 107. Glad to be back. If you are one of the people checking out Extreme Rules this Sunday, do enjoy the show. I always say it. I won't be checking it out, but I will certainly be following the results online on SEScoops.com, as you should be too. And we'll talk about that. We'll talk about the draft. We'll see if TNA took one step forward or two steps back with their show this upcoming week. The spoilers didn't instill a lot of confidence in me. But again, let's see how it plays out on TV first. And hopefully, without any issues, we'll be back with episode 108 next weekend. On that note, be well, stay safe. Thanks for supporting the show, as always, and we will be back here next week.
You've been listening to The Sama Monster.
You know, I really just don't understand what they're doing.
Anybody agree with me out there?
I mean, anybody. Come on, throw me a bone here.
Probably the single dumbest thing I've ever seen in my entire life.
God, I love this business. On SE Scoops.